are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, May 14th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Ken Silverstein, senior investigative reporter with First Look Media, on his new book, The Secret World of Oil. Also on the program today, tomorrow, Net Neutrality Commission, or I should say the FCC, holding a vote on net neutrality. Is tomorrow is their vote? Idaho strikes down marriage equality ban. Marco Rubio follows up his climate denialism with a reform of our Social Security, I should say, in quotes. In Newark, charter school proponents take a huge blow. And Chris Christie involved in another scandal, which may also implicate the Massachusetts governor race.
Dude.
Senate race. Governor race.
Dude.
Could be crazy. And Tim Geithner. Shocking. Well, not really. Not that shocking. Tim Geithner attempts to whitewash his tenure as Treasury Secretary and simply basically confirms just about every criticism that has ever been leveled against him and maybe enhances it.
I think enhances. That's pretty stunning.
But the guy's got a book to sell because apparently at that, what is it? A hedge fund he's working at? That financial.
Walter Pincus?
Something like that. Yes. Yeah. He's not making enough money there. His comment on why he had to go into the private sector was quite interesting. We will talk a little bit about some of the excerpts from his book. We're not going to talk about it too much because F that guy. However, I do have a piece here. What did I do with that I wanted to start the show with? Son of a gun. Can't find it. Well, it was basically, I don't know, it was one of those, found out the real reason behind global warming. Oh, here it is. Yeah, forgive me. You know, there was the National Climate Assessment Report came out last week. And but Christian Post blogger Michael Brescianini has weighed in on what the real reason for climate change is. He says, all that the Bible reveals about climate change is part of the premillennial prophetic message. It does say that earthquakes and violent storms, fires, and other natural disasters will occur with greater intensity and frequency as the last days approach. But it clearly says these are birth pangs for a planet about to meet its creator. It does not attribute any of these portents to global warming or man-made global carbon footprint. Sorry! I love the condescension from a guy who's quoting the Bible as to what global warming is. After almost a half a century spent studying and teaching on the prophecies of the second coming of Christ, I can say with absolute confidence that this world does not end because of global warming or man-made climate change. It does not, in fact, play into the prophecies of the last days at all. The second coming of Christ is not precipitated by the heating up of the planet, but by the burning desire of men to live in unbridled perversion and sin. Homosexuality, abortion, general sexual preoccupation, and sleazy self-serving politics and world governance brings the Antichrist to this short-lived rule over a reprobate and dying world. Global warming will be the least of our worries. So, sorry, Mr. Obama, your facts are fallacy, and the subject of climate change is also above your pay grade.
If we could just get serious for a second, I'd like to talk Bible privacy. So let's put down the climate models and the carbon dating for just a second, because it's time to get a little robust in this conversation.
We have a book that talks about this, folks. It's called the Bible. Woo. Cuckoo. All right. Let's take a break and talk to Ken Silverstein. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Ken Silverstein, former Harper's Washington editor, an investigative former investigative reporter for Los Angeles Times, and now a senior investigative reporter with First Look Media, author of the newly released The Secret World of Oil. Welcome to the program, Ken.
Thank you.
So, Ken, I think to a certain extent we all have a vague notion that, obviously the idea of oil as a problem in terms of our environment and a sort of a broad understanding of how oil is really one of the primary, if not the primary resource that has fundamentally affected our foreign policy and caused us to engage in, at least in recent times, a lot of, well, war, frankly. Your book sort of fills in almost sort of like the glue on how this works. Give us let's just start with this broad overview of why you focused on, I guess, what you call the fixers and the traders and the sort of the middlemen here.
Well, first off, you're right about, the role of oil in generating conflict. I mean, it is obviously the fuel, literally, that makes the global economy work. And so there's a lot of competition over it. And I wouldn't go so far as to say that the Iraq war was all about oil, but anybody who thinks that the planners of that war weren't looking at maps of the region and analyzing data about how much oil comes from that region and that Iraq might have in its territory has got to be dreaming. I mean, clearly it was a factor in the war and probably a pretty big one. I looked at the fixers and the oil traders in particular the middlemen, really, between the oil companies and third world governments where most of the oil is found. I mean, this is one of the reasons that oil is so corrupt and why it's had such a big impact on our foreign policy is because most of it historically has been found in the third world in countries that are pretty corrupt, sometimes because we've installed corrupt regimes there. And most of it is pumped out, or a lot of it is pumped out by Western companies and shipped to the first world to run our planes and tanks and factories, and cars, of course. So I focused on these middlemen because nobody has, and I'm an investigative reporter, and so that was really interesting to me. These are people who, as I said, broker the deals between the companies and the government. So if you're Exxon, for example, purely for example, and you want to get a oil concession in Nigeria, it's not like the Nigerian government is going to put out a bid and then, you know, do a closed-door review of the bids and award the contract to the best bidder, the bid that will do the best for the people of Nigeria. They're going to be looking for, you know, when they dole out that contract, they're going to be looking for who's going to do best for them, as in the, you know, the senior officials of the Nigerian government. And the people are of little concern. Nigeria's pumped hundreds of billions of dollars worth of oil over the last 30 or 40 years, and I remember once talking to a CIA official who said he had traveled to Nigeria pretty extensively, and in interviewing people there, you know, the view that he heard was that Nigeria would have been off if the oil had just been left in the ground, because it's all been, you know, pumped out, caused a lot of environmental destruction, and very, you know, a small group of people have gotten very rich off of it. So anyway, you need in Nigeria or Equatorial Guinea or Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan, in a lot of places, oil companies rely on these middlemen who, you know, the old model was that they just flat out bribed government officials. So, you know, the oil companies would pay them to be consultants. You know, I put consultants, or I'll put consultants in quotes, and they get these huge fees, and they take part of their fee and wire it into a Swiss account controlled by the president of whatever country he was negotiating with, and he'd keep the rest. That was the way it worked, you know, just pretty standard corruption. And now it's become a lot more complicated, partly because of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and European laws that banned bribery about 10 years ago. Until about 10 years ago, you could deduct your bribes on your taxes in Europe. But now it's gotten more complicated. So you look for ways to pay off government officials, hopefully without flat out bribing them. But sometimes, no doubt, you know, you still have money that's just directly funneled into maybe an offshore account controlled by the oil minister's nephew or something like that. But sometimes, you know, the oil companies, you can periodically somebody goes to jail. There's a senior Halliburton official who's in jail for being complicit in a scheme to bribe senior Nigerian officials to get, I think it was a $6 billion gas contract over there. Jack Stanley is the name of the executive, and he went to jail. But often they're looking for ways to not flat out bribe officials, but to basically do the same thing. So, for example, Exxon wants in Equatorial Guinea, which is a small country on the west coast of Africa, you know, 500,000 people, and suddenly a lot of oil was discovered over there. You can't do business over there without basically paying off the government officials. The President Obiang seized power in 1979. He's not going anywhere. He and his family, it's basically a crime syndicate running that country. So if you want to do business over there, you are going to pay for the privilege. So Exxon did a bunch of things to get the privilege. And, for example, Obiang owns a whole lot of land in Equatorial Guinea, the president. He swiped it. I mean, he came to power in 1975 and just stole a lot of it. But Exxon wanted land for its compound and maybe for some of its development over there. So they bought it from President Obiang, and they probably paid way more than the land was worth. It's hard to evaluate land values over there, but it's almost certain that they paid far more than it's worth. It's just a new way to bribe governments. They also hired the Minister of Security, who was listed in State Department reports as a torturer. He had a security company. They hired his company to guard, you know, to provide some sort of service guarding their compound or something or other. So, you know, it's the way it's always worked. But it's rarely seen the light of day. So I thought it would be an interesting topic to look at.
I mean, you know, and I want to get into some of the specifics, because you spent quite a bit of time in the book with Obiang and sort of just the lifestyle that he leads. And there's also a couple other specific characters I'd like to talk about, just because it's fascinating. But broadly speaking, let's talk about the sort of there's sort of two ends of this dynamic. One is that these guys are, I mean, they're out for themselves on some level, but they are subjugating ultimately. I mean, you're talking millions of people in terms of, if you are unlucky enough to live above that oil, it just creates this dynamic. I mean, it obviously stifles any type of democracy in that country, right? And it has, what kind of effect does it have on our end of it? I mean, we're the ones pulling the oil out of the ground, more or less.
Well, several people I talked to, you know, including some of the middlemen and a former Chevron executive named Ed Chow, said, you know, hey, if Americans want cheap gas, this is part of the price we're going to pay for it. There's just, you can't have democracy in these countries without, if you've got oil, if you want cheap oil, if you're going to get it from these countries and pay less for it, because we're bribing people, that's the price to be paid. I should say he was not in any way justifying that. He was simply stating it as a fact of life. As long as Americans want cheap oil, we can't have democracy in these countries. I mean, you know, if you're an oil company and you want, in Equatorial Guinea, for example, you know, you've had a government in power for 35 years, just one of the world's most rotten regimes. I mean, the oil companies in some ways, I suppose, would probably prefer not to be dealing with corrupt governments. But on the other hand, it's quite convenient. They enjoy it. They like it because it's easy. You know, if you're going in Texas, for example, you know, there's a benefit. I mean, you know, this is a subject of controversy, but the wealth generated by oil, obviously, everywhere it flows mostly to the top. But in Texas, you know, if you've got oil on your land and the companies are pumping it, you're getting a royalty. A lot of money have done, a lot of people have done well for themselves. It creates, you know, oil typically is not one of the greatest job producing industries, but it produces some jobs. But in Equatorial Guinea, in Texas, you know, I mean, I've traveled to Texas. I've traveled to Louisiana, oil rich states. And oil's created a lot of damage, but there's no question many residents of those states are pro-oil. I mean, they do like the industry because a lot of people have benefited from it. And, you know, there's no, you know, whatever you think of oil, there's just no denying that. I mean, we may think that it's destroying the planet, but that's just a fact of life. In Equatorial Guinea, you don't have that. You can't build popular support in Equatorial Guinea, because you've got a government that's stealing all of the oil wealth, and it creates very few jobs overseas. When you're just taking it out of the ground or from under the ocean, it creates very few jobs. And in a lot of these countries, many of those jobs don't go to locals. So there's no way that the population is going to support oil. So if you have to, you know, if you have to build popular support in Equatorial Guinea, forget it. But if there's a dictator in power, and all you have to do is make him and a few other people happy, and you've got some money to throw around, whether it's a direct bribe or you just overpay for his stolen land for your, you know, oil development, it's great. I mean, it's real easy to line up the support you need because it's just a few people.
Right. It's just a question of how much is it going to be? We know it's a number. We just got to figure out what that number is.
Exactly. And you know also that that number, you know, compared to the profits you're going to make, is going to be tiny. Because Obiang, by some estimates, the president of Equatorial Guinea, is one of the, I think he was rated by Forbes at one point as the sixth or eighth richest head of state. And that's pretty astonishing because it's a very small country. So, you know, he's stolen a ton of money. Most of it, though, is just the, you know, the oil is, there's a state oil company that takes a big cut, and certainly some of that, a lot of that money goes into the pockets of the ruling family. But, you know, whatever Exxon overpaid for the land, or however much they paid the security company owned by the Minister of Security to guard their compound or their property, it's a tiny amount of money. I mean, if you're throwing around $10 million in bribes, say, and you're making billions and billions of dollars in profits, who cares? It's literally pocket change. So, yeah, you don't have to spread around too much vis-a-vis the profits you get. So it's easy. You know, why bother? It's no fun having to line up public support when you can just pay off a few top people.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that dynamic, I mean, it occurs to me that there's a story that in coming out of Ottawa that the Canadian government may sue the United States for its delay on approving Keystone under a provision of NAFTA, which, you know, essentially equalizes, which basically says, you know, you can't stand in the way. We have a deal, and you can't stand in the way of us shipping this oil through your country based upon whatever environmental concerns, et cetera. And this is supposedly the model of the TPP. And in some ways, it is to conform. I mean, it just occurs to me as you were explaining that dynamic that it has the similar process where it's, we need to eliminate the, it is far more effective for industry to eliminate, when we're talking about transnational exchange of resources and money, we need to eliminate that sort of messy part about the people on the ground who may have the political will or desire to not have us do this thing. And it's easier, obviously, if there's a dictator. But in some ways, it's sort of like that's what corporations don't want to have to deal with the, I guess, the uncertainty of democracy.
Yeah, definitely not. It's, you know, and here we just, in some ways, I actually had a trader, an oil trader in Geneva, say to me, hey, you know, you call that corruption, what, you know, in the third world when bribes are paid. But it's basically the same way we do it. We just have lobbyists and political action committees, and you make contributions to politicians. It's just a different form of bribery, but it's basically the same thing. So, yeah, I mean, in a sense, you know, over in Equatorial Guinea, you don't pay for lobbyists. You spend that money on making government officials happy. And here, you just, you know, you spend a whole lot of money. You may even spend more. It's probably well more expensive to hire lobbyists and make all these political contributions than it is to bribe people. But you're, you know, basically trying to do the same thing. You're lining up political support in this country and in Canada and in other places. You line up political support in one way, and in Equatorial Guinea and Kazakhstan, you just go straight to the top and line up, you know, 5 or 10 top people, and all is well.
Is oil a unique commodity in terms of this dynamic? I mean, you know, maybe that's outside of your purview, but I mean, is there something specific about oil just because it is so necessary in every society, and it sort of cheap oil basically brings a certain amount of economic stability. Is it unique beyond that too in terms of these dynamics?
Well, it certainly is unique. You know, it's not a coincidence that oil is generally deemed to be the most corrupt industry. The only thing that compares with it, if you look at Foreign Corrupt Practice Act prosecutions, or if you just generally look at big, big international corruption cases, oil pops up more than anything, even more than weapons, arms trafficking, which is the second. I would guess, is probably the second most corrupt industry. And the reason for that is one of the things that I noted above is, noted earlier, is that a lot of it is found in countries known for corruption in Africa, Central Asia, and elsewhere, and shipped to richer countries. So you have, you know, you're dealing with, when you're dealing with an Obiang in Equatorial Guinea, cash is going to change hands. So it's just, you know, it's geography. But another reason is that oil is so incredibly sensitive that a very small group of people deal with it, especially in the countries that produce it. Oil is, you know, the two, I had someone once just say to me that the two, he described them as sovereign goods. The only two sovereign goods, two goods most important to the state are oil and weaponry. You need weapons to protect your borders, or in some cases, unfortunately, to repress your people so that they don't overthrow you. And you need oil to run your military and your economy. And so there's, in a lot of places, there's just a handful of people who are dealing with these decisions that involve billions and billions and billions of dollars. You know, that's another thing about oil. If you're selling socks, you know, you need to get a whole bunch of little contracts to make money. If you're selling oil, you just need one or two. The stakes are incredibly high. I mean, if you're selling socks and you lose a million sock deal, it's not the end of the world. I mean, you try to close every deal. But if you're trying to get a concession in Kazakhstan that you may make money on for 20 years, the stakes are really, really high. And for all of those reasons, oil just tends to be, it doesn't tend to be. For those reasons, it is more corrupt than most any other industry, probably any other industry.
You know, it's interesting. I hadn't realized that. I mean, it makes sense to hear it. But one of the things that occurred to me relative to your book is the a story that a guy named Guy Lawson is writing about those two stoner arms dealers who got caught down in Florida. And the one of the dynamics there is that, you know, it was not so that on some level these guys, the U.S. government just sort of turned an eye, just didn't look in the right direction. You know, it's one of those things like, you know, the cop on the beat is just like, you know, I'm only going to look to my left. So whatever you do on your right, that's okay. And it's, you know, there's this relationship, it seems, that you talk about in your book where the U.S. government is aware of this, of these type of things, but it's, as long as we don't see it, and the companies too. I mean, there's this sort of notion of like, let's just keep this at arm's length, and so that, you know, we need it to happen. We just don't need it to happen. We just need deniability.
Oh, absolutely. Everybody knows what's going on. I mean, this stuff is well known in small circles, certainly in government circles. And there was a U.S. businessman named Jim Giffen who was a middleman between oil companies and the government of Kazakhstan. And he was actually indicted and tried in the United States for allegedly funneling money to the president of Kazakhstan and the prime minister. This is, I think, about $80 million. And U.S. oil companies who were paying him as a consultant got very, very big concessions in Kazakhstan. And Giffen, to the best of my knowledge, never really denied sending the money to the president of Kazakhstan. But his defense, it was a graymail defense, was, you know, I was doing this for the U.S. government. Everybody knew what I was doing. The CIA knew, the State Department knew, and everybody was happy because I was working to get American oil companies huge concessions, you know, very valuable concessions in Kazakhstan. And in the end, the judge basically tossed the case, dragged on for many, many, many years. And the judge said, you know, you're an American hero. You, you know, your government's been persecuting you, but all along the government knew what you were doing and didn't complain about it. It just turned a blind eye because it was convenient, because we wanted those concessions for American companies, not the competing firms. And it's hard to argue with that. I mean, if you look at Giffen's context with the U.S. government, you know, his relationship with the president was not a secret. That he was working for U.S. oil companies was not a secret. I mean, you know, the president of Kazakhstan would come to Washington and Giffen would show him around and, you know, bring him to meet government officials and host parties for him. So, you know, I think fundamentally he was telling the truth about his working with the explicit consent and approval of the U.S. government. So that's definitely, you know, you just, for the most part, I think the attitude is, as long as we don't know what's, you know, we may suspect what's going on, we may basically know, but as long as, you know, nobody really brings it to our attention, who cares? I mean, it's just, you know, it's business. That's the way it works.
How does a guy like that, like Giffen or that Halliburton official you talked about, how do they end up being prosecuted for this in that context? I mean, what is there just something that is just so flagrant? I mean, is there are there rogue elements of the U.S. government that are saying we're going to actually try and crack down on this? Or is it just like rival oil companies, you know, mail an envelope full of evidence when they want to when they want some type of advantage?
Well, I wouldn't be that sinister or conspiratorial about it myself, although I tend to be pretty cynical in general. I think when we talk about the U.S. government, we're talking about millions and millions of people. We're not talking about, you know, 10 people at the State Department and the CIA and the President and Secretary of State. You're talking about millions of people. And there are people in the Justice Department, for example, or the SEC, who every once in a while, you know, evidence may be presented to them. They may learn through a news report or yet possibly, who knows, a competing oil company or whatever. Something comes to their attention and they are, you know, their job is to prosecute companies for if they're operating corruptly overseas. And so they do it. And I think there have definitely been times when you've had a conflict between arms of the government where, and I expect this was true of the Giffen case that I was referring to, where you have maybe the CIA and parts of the State Department that are saying, what, you know, why are we doing this? Why is this guy being prosecuted? You know, this is just a big mess. We don't need this sort of publicity. But there are career officials at some agencies who are doing their job. I mean, I don't think it's a question of, you know, the president snapping his fingers and making a decision and everybody marches to that tune. So you have competing interests. And I think mostly these cases just don't come to anyone's attention. These are deals that are cut in the dark. Nobody ever knows about them. So every once in a while, something comes out, as I said, either through journalism or, you know, the investigators in the government digging up information. And, you know, you have individuals who want to move a case forward. So it happens from time to time. And sometimes I do think the government tries to squelch those investigations that, you know, other parts of the government that don't like it. But, you know, the government, as I said, it's millions of people. So we can't just refer to it as this, this monolith.
I want to talk about a couple of the characters in the book because it just sort of gives people, I think, a sense of who these people are, obviously. But talk a little bit about what Tony Blair has been up to. I couldn't believe how much guy this guy is making on just giving talks. I'm definitely motivated to get into the.
I did a chapter. He's not really a middleman, but I wrote about.
Is he like a fixer or what? Or what? I mean, in that world, where you talk about the sort of you've got the traders and the fixers and sort of, I guess, the Uber fixers. Is he like an Uber fixer or something?
Well, I put him in a different category, really. I mean, he's operating at a somewhat different level, and he does mostly different things. I mean, he does broker deals, I think. There's no question about that. But, he's not his business. He's got a consulting firm, and he's hired to do all sorts of things. I mean, it's not as narrow as just oil either. So I just looked at, the chapter about him was a chapter about flax and promoters of the industry. And so Blair is available, to do, he profits from this in a few ways. I mean, one is, when he was prime minister, he became very close to the president of Kazakhstan. He developed relationships around the world in a lot of, energy rich states. And, he afterwards, for reasons that are mysterious, he got paid huge sums of money as a consultant by some of these governments. I mean, the government of Kazakhstan, I can't even remember how many millions of dollars it paid him. The government of Kuwait paid him. Unfortunately, I don't even have the book in front of me. But tens of millions of dollars to write some report on its, a review of its economy that, according to members of the opposition in Kuwait, I remember people said that the report was just filled with, obvious information, and, nobody could understand why he was paid that sum of money. But I think just in a lot of cases,
to be fair, though, didn't he do it in freehand and it was all calligraphy?
Yeah, nobody really. Maybe that's what it was. But so there, there's that angle where he, developed relationships as prime minister, and, some of the people he was friendly with were in a position to hire him after he went into the private sector. And then secondly, he's made this huge sums of money, giving speeches around the world. And I believe his minimum rate, that I came across at one point was, I think it was $100,000, or it may have even been more than that.
Yeah, he made $20 million per year.
Right, between consulting and these talks. I mean, sometimes he's just making, he's getting paid $300,000 to give a talk that's less than an hour. But I discussed a couple of talks he gave in my book where he was paid a lot of money to give speeches in Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan. And, just embarrassing. I mean, in Azerbaijan, which, this is another, it's like Equatorial Guinea, one of those really, really rotten regimes. You've got a president whose family has gotten enormously wealthy. The very repressive government. There was a WikiLeaks cable where I can't remember, was it the ambassador in Azerbaijan or another official in the embassy? They described the ruling family of Azerbaijan. They compared them to the Corleone family of The Godfather. And, Blair went over there, and there was a businessman very close to the regime who was opening a gigantic methanol plant. And Blair went over there and made a pile of money to give a short speech in which he lauded the president of Azerbaijan and he talked about how wonderful methanol is, as if he actually knew anything about it. It's just, if you offer enough money, he's willing apparently to say anything.
And what is the impact of Blair doing that? I mean, so he's like clearly providing an imprimatur that does what? I mean, are you there?
Yeah.
I'm in my mind, because we hear these stories in the main, that, I don't know, Larry Summers or Timothy Geithner is getting hundreds of thousands of dollars, they give this imprimatur. What does it do that they get this imprimatur? Like, hey, if Tony Blair is friends with the Azerbaijan, he can't be that bad of a guy.
Right. Well, I think that in part it's just often payback for, you know, friendship and past favors. And so it's an easy way for governments to reward Blair for his favorable stance when he was in power. Same thing happened with the Bush family, where, you know, after the first Bush administration ended, you had a number of senior officials and relatives going over to Kuwait, you know, because the Kuwaitis, of course, were eternally grateful to the Bush family and George Bush Sr. for invading, you know, driving Iraq out of Kuwait. And so I think partly it's just, you know, gee, you were really nice to us when you were prime minister, Mr. Blair, and now we can return the favor. And partly I think it just looks good. Yeah, I mean, I don't think the local populations in these places where Blair speaks is super impressed with it, but it's a good photo op and a good news hit. You know, Tony Blair goes over to Azerbaijan and lends legitimacy to this rotten regime. So, you know, it's a cheap way. It doesn't, I mean, the owner of this methanol plant who paid him, I think, £100,000 or something like that. It's not really very expensive. He's going to make a whole lot of money on the methanol plant. And, you know, it looks nice to have Tony Blair come over. It was actually, I think he brought him over to inaugurate, you know, the inauguration of the plant or the construction of the plant. So, you know, it's cheap PR, looks good. Blair gets a lot of money. Everybody's happy.
So, I mean, just to sort of, you know, to bring this home, when we look at these people who are the sort of the intermediaries, and they're obviously crucial to the functioning, I guess, of this, I don't know, this this industry. I mean, what at the end of the day, I mean, how much are they in the event that we do, because a lot of people are talking now about the sort of the broader implications of trying to wean us off of oil or move into a new era. I think, you know, Chris Hayes wrote a piece recently calling, you know, what needs to be done in terms of dealing with climate change relative to carbon companies is something, you know, akin to abolition. I mean, to what extent is this part of the apparatus sort of holding it up, or is it something that's just going to be a casualty in the event that we do get to that place where we somehow wean ourselves off the idea of really cheap oil?
Well, it's hard to answer that question because in my view, it's going to be a long, long time before we wean ourselves off of cheap oil. I mean, you know, our oil, relatively speaking, I guess, is more expensive than it was in the 1970s, certainly, but it's still pretty cheap, especially when you compare what we pay with what most people around the world pay for it. You know, it's a very cheap commodity. Everybody expects oil to be relatively cheap or gas to be relatively cheap. So I think it's going to be, you know, a long, long time. I mean, that you just, the companies are just making too much money off of it. That's why you continue to see the climate deniers and this just refusal to confront the issue head on. You know, Americans prefer cheap oil. I think a lot of people don't think about the implications of it. And, you know, the companies are making a lot of money, and the companies have an extraordinary amount of influence with the government. So, you know, not optimistic that this situation is going to change anytime soon. Sort of seems premature to talk about the post-carbon era.
Well, I guess I'm curious as to, you know, well, I mean, I guess it's just sort of there's just so much money sloshing around that those fixers and the PR people, they're a small segment of the enormous wealth that is going around, whether it's the dictators who are receiving that money or the corporations in this country. But I'm always looking to see if there's a weak underbelly somewhere, and it doesn't look like there is.
Well, I mean, it's unfortunately, I'd love to give you a different answer, but, you know, if I'm going to be honest, it's hard for me to see a quick transition You know, and I frankly don't think that, you look at people talk about, you know, the world running out of oil, but then shale fracking comes along.
Right.
And alternative, alternative means of obtaining energy. So it may not be good for us, but as long as the companies can do it and make money and the government is facilitating all that, it's hard to see a rapid transition. I don't think we're running out of fossil fuels. So as long as you have that situation, it doesn't look good in terms of a swift transition.
Ken Silverstein, a senior investigative reporter with First Look Media, the author of The Secret World of Oil. It will be on majority.fm, a link, obviously, to that book. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program today, wherein we will talk about all the fun involved in net neutrality, the vote that's going on, but also the fun that's going on in Idaho as they have struck down their ban on marriage equality, or at least a federal judge has. We'll talk about this race in Newark, which, I mean, it's fascinating. I think it shows one, a huge amount of pushback against charter schools, two, a much, much weakened Chris Christie in New Jersey, and those who, Democrats, Republicans alike, who have allied themselves with Chris Christie. And then, of course, there's also a story about how Chris Christie may have some problems with a pay-to-play scheme in New Jersey about their pension fund. All that and more. Also, interesting fight that's happening in Michigan, or at least in the senatorial race, where somebody's running on the existence of climate change, not on denying it. And maybe we'll read some of that Geithner stuff, too. All right, we've got to take a break. We'll be back. You can become a member of this program. Of course, I should say, freebies yesterday missed out on a lot of fun that we had yesterday. And all I can tell you is become a member today. Then you can get the archive of all the member shows, go back to it. Become a member today at majority.fm, just pennies a day, ladies and gentlemen. Like 33 pennies. I don't know if anybody's walking around with that many pennies, but it's pennies a day. You can also support this program by buying your junk. If you buy it from Amazon, buy it through our link at majoritypreportkickback.com. Go to majoritypreportkickback.com, click on the link with the Amazon logo, bookmark it. That's your Amazon. Go there. You'll notice no difference, but we get a kickback from majoritypreportkickback.com. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Give us a review on iTunes. Pick up our app if you are, there's thousands of you who have not, but there are also thousands of you who have. You can get it at majorityapp.com. All right, folks, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of the program, you can also IM me at Majority FM or via the app. Super easy, one-touch IMing via the app. We'll be back in a minute.